Great to have you along here on the Ideas Network as we take a look at Wisconsin wildlife with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller. Happy to have you listening in. And if you have a question about some wildlife in your area, or maybe not in your area, or an experience, I hope you'll join in with a call at 1-800-642-1234 or by emailing us at talk@wpr.org. Scott, good to have you back.
It's great to be back.
Spring is here, early.
Spring came with a vengeance and very rapidly. I mean, it only seems like maybe 3 weeks ago that we were buried in snow and ice, and boom, it was gone literally in a flash, and we bypassed the 40s, 50s, and 60s and went right to the 70s. So, yeah, things have happened very quickly. Green up is right on the edge here around the Madison area. Lots of wildlife activity, and ice is off the northern lakes as early as I can remember. So,
and
lots of things.
Yeah, the winter, did have any impact on the wildlife?
Well, it seemed like it was shaping up to be a pretty long snow and ice covered period, but coming off a couple winters that were considerably worse in terms of duration of ice or duration of deep snow, I don't think it was too bad, at least down here. And the Northwood snow disappeared fairly quickly, too. So all in all, I think it was probably a relatively benign winter. But again, if folks have seen impacts of winter that they want to report, that's the thing we like to hear folks call in. And
let us know. Yeah, and Kathy in Green Bay is up with a question or comment, so let's go to her. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. My question is, we have a red cardinal that just all day long bangs into my window, then goes to the next house and hits the window, and it just does that all day long. Is it ill, or what would cause it?
No, it's fine. And in fact, it's probably got a bit of an overdose, so hormonally speaking. It is a fairly common spring event for cardinals, male robins, a couple other species to attack. What it's doing is not attacking your window. It thinks it's attacking another cardinal because it sees its reflection in your window. So it's a spring territorial thing, and bird breeding activity is getting underway very rapidly here. And likely the bird has a mate with a nest somewhere in the area. And it looks at your window from its perch, and he says, "Holy cow, there's a male cardinal in my territory. I'm going to get him," and bang, into the window. And unfortunately, the reflection never disappears. So the bird will repeatedly and diligently attack that reflection for sometimes hours on end. So it's a highly seasonal thing this time of year for maybe a matter of a few weeks, depending on the bird. You can either grin and bear it, knowing that there's an end in sight, or does it always seem to be one particular window?
Yes.
Okay, then that's a little easier. If you can do anything to deaden the reflection of that bird, I mean, go outside, look at your own reflection in the window, and then see what you can do by drawing drapes or in some cases even soaping the window or draping something over it so that the bird can't see his reflection. And if you're lucky, he'll simply go somewhere else or cease the behavior rather than moving to another window. The foolproof way is to get a sheet of plastic bird netting, which garden centers carry to protect berry bushes and fruit trees from bird depredations. You can get a sheet of that and then just drape it down over the window on the outside so that it's suspended several inches from the window, and then the bird won't be able to get at his reflection. So there are a couple of alternatives, and if you go to a bird feeding store, they'll also sell dark or black silhouettes of hawks or other things that you can put on the window that will also discourage the behavior.
There you have it, Kathy. Thank you very much for calling. Let's turn to Joe and Gaze Mills next. Hi, Joe.
Good morning. I have a coyote issue.
Okay.
I've never really appreciated the definition of the verb hounding until my dog that I got from the shelter, he's got some hound in him.
Mm-hmm.
And he and a coyote have developed a relationship over the last month. He goes up and barks at this coyote. The coyote sometimes barks back. And then they do this standoff where the coyote charges him and he retreats, and then he'll advance and the coyote will retreat. And I'm wondering, is this just a springtime thing? Is he or she just protecting a den? Because it's getting, I mean, I'm standing out behind my shop now looking at my pooch. She's in the woods here, but so is the coyote. But the coyote's getting close to the house. And, I mean, really close. I know this coyote's face. So I'm wondering, is this a question of patience or drastic action?
When you say you know the coyote's safe, in what
face.
Sense?
No, I face. Said I know
oh,
he's safe.
Oh, face.
Safe.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right, sorry. Well, you know, people have various responses. Coyotes are around virtually everywhere, whether people see them or realize they're there, they are there. And in the dark of night, they're probably very close to your house and a lot of other houses as well. So that's not an immediate problem, unless in the case of a pet, you have a fairly small pet, small dog, cat, something like that, then that animal is at some risk to the coyotes. A larger dog, like yours apparently, may have a bit of a standoff here. Chances are the coyote has a mate in a den somewhere in the woods or up on a hillside or rock outcrop or something not too far from your house. And it's attempting to keep the dog at bay, and the dog's attempting to keep the coyote at bay, and as you say, they've got a bit of a standoff. You certainly don't want them to get into a tussle. I mean, a large dog can probably hold its own, but somebody's going to get a little chewed up in the process. Whether this is a... If you're satisfied to watch it progress as a standoff and see the behavior dwindle over the course as the breeding season winds down, you're probably okay. Otherwise, then you may want to take some steps to put a little more wildness in the coyote.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. You can join in as well at 1-800-642-1234. Suzanne in Hortonville, on to you. Hi, Suzanne.
Yes, hi. I'm so glad that you have the show. It's very interesting. I have a question that's similar to the last caller, except that I am concerned we have biannual hunters in our area that come in with pickup trucks and hounds, and they surround our property. It's not on our property, and they will, by the end of 2 days, have many, many, many fox and coyote carcasses in the backs of their trucks.
Mm-hmm.
I am very upset about this. I don't know if this is legal or illegal, and I'm just concerned why this is occurring.
All right, Scott.
Well, fox and coyote hunting are fairly popular in some parts of the state, and hunting them with hounds, a trained pack of hounds, is a standard way to go about it, although there are other ways. Some people will hunt solo and call the animals in with a predator call that sounds like a distressed rabbit or some other technique. So there are different ways to hunt the animals, but hunting them in a group with pickup trucks and trained hounds and radio communication and all that kind of thing is one of the tactics that appeals to some folks, and they pursue it very vigorously. I guess I'm not sure why they would only show up in alternate years. That may just be a matter of, you know, they're rotating between hunting spots or letting the populations rebound or whatever. I don't know about that. But what they're doing, unless they're trespassing or causing some problems in that regard, the hunting is perfectly legal, and as long as they are on public land or have permission to be on private land in question, then, you know, they're... It's not something they do. It's no different than bear hunting in northern Wisconsin when folks may see the bear hunters out and about with trucks and hounds. And probably realistically, Suzanne, I mean, you say you don't like it, and, you know, I understand that you may want to have a few more foxes around, but it is a legal activity, and no hunting pressure, no matter how proficient these folks are or how good their hounds are, they would never eliminate a population. It's just not possible, and animals will move back in anyway. So the notion that you won't see much is probably not the case, and removal of a few coyotes is probably a good thing. Number one, that cuts down on some of the kinds of calls that we get and other people get, like Joe, who just called from Gay's Mills and was concerned about a coyote. And removing some coyotes is also a very good thing for the fox population because the two animals don't get along very well.
Okay.
Thinning out the coyotes a bit would be a good thing for the fox population.
No.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And more callers online. Let's go to Christine in Vinland.
That's the town of Vinland. That's right.
Yeah. All right. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. I'm making an observation with the spring migration of birds. It seems they're a bit early, bluebirds, killdeers, meadowlarks. But in particular, I've noticed that there's a hummingbird migration website that tracks the migration of the hummingbirds. And there's a couple of people that have noted already hummingbirds in southern Wisconsin about April 4th. Is that possible, or is that early?
Well, it's very early.
And we would never
say anything's impossible. Birds generally follow the freeze-thaw line north, and they're pretty capable of detecting where it is. Some will move north, and then if things turn nasty again, they'll retreat back south in short bursts north and south until eventually they work their way back as far north as they want to go. It's a bit early for hummingbirds because, of course, food sources are going to be pretty limited for a while yet, even though green-up is occurring very, very quickly. So I assume if people did see them, either those are advanced birds that may have some problems or they may retreat a bit. Everything related to spring is happening very quickly and happening fairly early. Birds that Larry and I were just talking to before the program went on were loons, and I was talking to a friend up in the Minocqua area this morning who said, gee, the ice is out extremely early on the Minocqua chain, the big lakes like Tomahawk, and ordinarily the loons seem to be just
right there,
lurking, waiting, and as soon as the ice is out, boom, the loons are right there on the lake. And his observation was they hadn't seen any loons yet, and Larry volunteered that there
seeing
are plenty
lots
of them out in front of his house on Lake Monona, so the loons seem to be stacked up a little bit here in the Madison area and general area waiting to move north, perhaps not quite sure yet that the ice is out. But generally speaking, there are always some early members of any population that move north, and it could work out for them. Gee, they get the best nesting territories. On the other hand, they could hit a bad stretch of weather here and be in trouble. But generally, that's not a huge drain on the population.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks a lot for calling. And Tony in Mequonigo, it's your turn. Hi, Tony.
Good morning.
Morning.
If I could, I'll hurry. I actually have two questions, and they're both serious to us. One of them is something last year, I think in the fall, dug up around certain plants. I don't know if they're looking for grubs, and they would flip over the turf just like you might be a poor golfer like me,
mm-hmm.
and duff the grain. Something, is some animal looking for something? My yard is full of little turned over pieces of sod.
Well, there are three possibilities. One is squirrels looking for cached nuts. Depending on, you can tell me which of these animals seems like the most likely issue. Squirrels will, of course, dig up scatter hoarded nuts that other squirrels have buried, but generally that's not very destructive of the turf. Skunks will dig up grubs. When the soil's moist and there's a lot of beetle grubs or whatnot in the soil, skunks can do a lot of damage.
They do a lot of damage.
But the real winner, in terms of picking up big chunks of sod, so it almost looks like somebody had a polo match on your lawn, or worse, would be raccoons. So it could be any one of the three. And in many of these kinds of mysteries over the last couple of years have been solved by folks who either beg, borrow, steal, or get from a friend one of these new motion-triggered trail cameras, and simply set that up on an area that's being affected by any problem, whether it's a mystery animal in the yard or something in the attic or whatever, set up the camera and boom, all of a sudden,
you know,
there it is. You know what's causing the problem. But it's one of those three, and based on your description of the severity, I'd blame raccoons.
Okay. And if I could, the other one is we have bats in our house for the first time in 40 years. I understand they don't like new buildings, but I had 4 bats in the last 6 months. In the living room, in the basement, and I remodel my own house. I'm a carpenter, and I don't know any place they can get in, but somehow they did. And they can be very frustrating because all of a sudden you're walking and downstairs, and there they are flying in circles, and they,
yeah,
they can knock you off balance.
Yes, having a bat flying around your house can certainly get your attention in a hurry. 4 bats in a living space over the course of the period of time when bats are normally either elsewhere or dormant for the winter is a pretty strong indication that you have a colony in the building somewhere, either in a wall void or in the attic or somewhere. Now, you're a carpenter, so it may be a little easier for you, but what you need to do is make a meticulous search, surface by surface, of the exterior of the house, to start high. Their entry point is usually high, not low, and all you're looking for is literally a crack that might only be 3/8 of an inch wide.
Like a dime.
Like a dime or well, usually more linear than round, but anyway, a fairly small opening. And it can be a missing something as simple as a missing soffit vent or something on a if you've got some sort of an attic ventilator or whatnot that doesn't have a screen where it enters the attic, where utility cables come in and perhaps the guard or ring is loose or missing or wasn't caulked, anything like that. That is seemingly too small to be effective, but it could be, those things have to be sealed up. Now, the tricky part is, if you do have a colony, you need to wait here. We need a little bit warmer weather when flying insects start to become fairly apparent so that those bats will leave your building, your house, in the evening to feed. And then if you've identified the opening, you can put a little one-way screen or what's called a bat check valve over that opening. And the bats can get out, and then once they've been excluded, 4 or 5 days of use of that kind of a device, you can go ahead and seal the opening up. If you seal it up now, just find, okay, missing soffit vent, oh, easy, I'll just staple a piece of screen over it, then you trap the bats inside, and in a frantic attempt to get out, they're going to be more likely to be flying around your living space, knocking you off balance or otherwise causing problems. So you need to wait until they're active, and that will also help you find the openings, too, because you can just go out and stand at diagonally opposite corners of the house and just at dusk keep your eyes open, and you'll see where the bats are coming and going from.
All right.
Okay?
There you have it. Thank you very much for calling. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking Wisconsin Wildlife with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Peter in Argyle up next. Let's go to Peter. Hi, Peter.
Yeah, hi there. I was wondering, since turkey hunting's coming up here, I was kind of wondering how soon the turkeys start mating before the season actually starts, which starts next Wednesday, and how long do they actually keep mating after the season? And okay. I can take my call out there.
Okay.
Well, there have been, I'm glad you brought that up, the turkey spring turkey season does open next Wednesday, and that's the first of 6 consecutive 5-day hunting periods that run Wednesday to Sunday from next week through late May. So turkey season will get underway. It's become a big deal in Wisconsin. Lots of people out, lots of turkeys taken. I think it was close to 52,000 last year. So it's a big deal, and people have been excited about the onset of spring happening as quickly as it has. Sometimes this first turkey hunting period still has snow and slop, and it's miserable weather, but this is shaping up to be really nice, and the turkey's been active, and the gobblers have been strutting and gobbling and displaying for the better part of a couple weeks now. So actual breeding activity in terms of hens being bred and initiating nesting is probably still ahead of us, but may happen a little earlier this year. Typically, from the hunter's perspective, they try and hunt during the early periods in late April, very early May, because that's the peak of activity as far as the gobblers are concerned. Once the hens are on nest, which typically is toward the latter part of that hunting window in May, then the turkeys become a little trickier. There's more vegetation in the woods. The whole situation has a little different dynamic. But breeding activity in terms of gobbler behavior has already started and will carry on intermittently until it fizzles out toward the latter part of May.
Mm-hmm. So by the end of May.
And by that point, most of the hens will be on a nest. If they lose a nest, they may have a second clutch and so forth, stretching things out into the summer. But the peak of the breeding activity is from about the time of the start of the season, which is now, through most of May.
And Jeff, did you have a related question as well?
Yes, thanks, guys. Say, what did you ever hear about Fisher, Martin, and raccoon climbing up into trees and taking turkeys out at night? Is there something to that or not?
Is that, are you thinking that's something we've had a call on previously or we're checking into?
No.
Okay, all right, so we're starting from scratch here.
Yeah.
Well, certainly turkeys do roost in trees, and they tend to pick big trees that are fairly open that they feel fairly secure in. And although they are vulnerable to some predators, especially hens on nest or the poults, the idea that many of them are being taken out of the trees I don't think is a big leak in the bucket.
No.
Maybe it happens occasionally, but generally speaking, certainly not a martin. They're too small and worry about other prey, and there aren't very many of them either. Fishers normally wouldn't have been considered much of an issue because nobody really thought the turkeys were going to extend far north enough to move into primary fisher range. Given the opportunity, fishers will capture, kill, and eat nearly anything they can get a hold of. So I assume if they had the opportunity, they might, as would a raccoon. But I just don't think the turkeys are all that vulnerable on the roost site. Although they are sleeping up there, as anybody who knows who snuck in under, tried to sneak in under a roost tree, the turkeys still know what's going on, and they'll just bust out of that tree and take off if they feel threatened.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's something happening in central Wisconsin here. It seems that we used to have, you know, little flocks of even 100 birds. And now, last summer, we only had two birds all summer around. And I just think something's getting them, and I'm not sure what it is.
I wouldn't necessarily draw the conclusion from fairly limited observations that something's getting them. The birds move around to find food sources. They collect in the winter in different areas. Just as an example, the farm that I hunt on in Iowa County, we were out there throughout the entire deer season and most of the fall last year and saw not turkey one. Zip, not a turkey. And we spent a lot of time in the woods and roaming around, and the owner was getting concerned, oh my gosh, where have all the turkeys gone? And same thing throughout the winter and wandering around out there, not a track, not a turkey, and even early up until about 2 weeks ago. And then all of a sudden, as the winter flocks began to break up and move back onto open territory, boom.
There
they are again. Seems like turkeys everywhere. So give it a chance. The permits, the hunting permits are distributed over a large landscape so that hunting is an unlikely culprit. And from a predation standpoint, turkeys are pretty capable of taking care of themselves. So it's always possible there's something weird going on in your area, Jeff, but I think this is just a matter of how the turkey distribution currently sits on the landscape.
Yeah. And speaking of license, there are still some permits out there.
Yes, checking this morning of the various zones now, the state has been consolidated into just a handful of zones as opposed to many, and two zones, Zone 1, which is southwestern Wisconsin, and Zone 3, which is the central part of the state, probably where Jeff is, still had for periods E and F, which are the last two periods in May, mid to late May, still had for anywhere from 5,000 to 10,000 permits available for each of those combinations. Two periods and two zones. So for folks who didn't get a permit or are still thinking about, hey, I should try that, here's an opportunity to buy a surplus permit online and give it a try.
All right.
Well, thanks, guys. I wish you guys were on twice a month.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And you can join in, too, at 800-642-1234 or email at talk@wpr.org. We have had an email from Charles. Has a pair of nesting pair of bluebirds near his cabin. The male likes to entertain himself by charging his reflection in windows and the car mirrors, car mirrors. What can be done to discourage him? If nothing is done, will he eventually give up? This is stressful for him. I'm not fond of his attack on the car. Not only does he go after his reflection, he also leaves droppings on the car. My bluebird of happiness is really the bluebird of poopiness.
Well, I mean, same situation as the cardinal. This is a very seasonal thing, but an aggressive male like that, it is probably stressful for the bird. They certainly expend a lot of energy they don't need to expend. In the car situation, if it's the rearview mirrors that are a problem, it seems like it'd be fairly easy to keep a couple grocery bags sitting there and just put them on over the mirrors when you're home, and that would eliminate that problem, or a shopping bag or something, or just drape a towel over the mirror. If it's the windows that are a problem, you know, same thing, a tarp pulled over the car or something, which might give it a little more protection anyway, would put an end to that problem.
And Jim in Bayfield County, on to you now. Hi, Jim.
Well, hello. I'm calling for two reasons. One is, I'm calling not just to thank Scott for his willingness to be our keynote speaker at the Wisconsin Lakes Conference, the Northwest Lakes Conference in June, up at Telemark in Cable, but also to point out that there is question number 61 on the Wisconsin Conservation Congress hearings this coming Monday has the potential of saving the lives of many eagles and loons and other waterfowl. And I would like your comments on lead toxicity and this question 61.
Before you go, Jim, do you have the text for question 61? We don't have the questionnaire here in front of us.
Well,
or at least the gist of it?
I'm on the Congress, and I'm on the Air, Waste, and Water Committee, and I should know it from memory. So I'll give it a shot. I believe the question says, do you favor the phase-out of toxic lead, I think it says fishing tackle,
okay,
but it's less than 1 ounce and less than 1 inch. So it's only the tiny sinkers and the tiny jigs that are the culprit. They are the ones that the loons are ingesting, and the other birds.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
they're ingesting those, and those are the ones that are killing those birds.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep. So it would be a phase out. If people approve of it, then it could lead to a possible phase out of small terminal tackle.
Okay. Well, first of all, I mean, lead is clearly toxic to wildlife in a variety of forms. And problems with lead have been recognized for many, many years. First and foremost, of course, with lead shot deposited by the tons in wetlands throughout the country for waterfowl hunting. And as most people realize, lead shot was banned a number of years ago for that purpose. And non-toxic alternatives, be it steel or many others, have been put in its place. And presumably that's been a major conservation tool for waterfowl conservation and other water birds in that setting. But fishing tackle is obviously next on the hit list. Split shot, there are gazillions of them used as kind of disposable sinkers, and jig heads and a variety of other things that do get into the environment. I think, Jim, if memory serves me correctly, there have been some voluntary programs going on already across the North Woods where people interested in this particular issue have had kind of voluntary bring your lead in and exchange it for free fishing lure or something like that in an attempt to get some of this stuff out of the environment. So overall, its toxicity is well recognized. Its problem for wildlife, particularly birds, has been well recognized. And eventually getting this stuff out of the environment would be a good thing. But I do think, again, we don't have the exact wording of the question, but a phase out is probably a good idea because if I think back to my various tackle boxes lying around the house, there's a lot of stuff in there that probably has some lead, and giving people a chance to phase it out before they have to all of a sudden say, okay, all this stuff's got to go and you need to move to non-toxic alternatives, might be hard on some folks. So a phase-out is a good idea. Good idea to get the lead out. Good idea to phase in a response to get it out.
Yep, absolutely. Thanks, Jim. Appreciate the call.
And that brings up the issue that the Conservation Congress hearings are coming up. Let's look at our notes here. Next Monday evening on April 12th at 7 p.m., every state will have a meeting. It's a public forum. You don't have to be a member of the Conservation Congress. You don't have to be a hunter, trapper, or fisher. Anybody can go to these hearings, and there's a questionnaire with a series of 97 questions, and 60 of those rule proposals come from the DNR. Others come from the Congress, like the one Jim just talked about, and people discuss these things, and ultimately they're voted on in an advisory capacity to the DNR board. So it's a chance for people to get out and have their opinions heard.
Let's turn to Bill in Iron River next. Bill, hello.
Hello. Hey, great show, you guys.
Thanks.
Hey, I got a question for you. You know, the fellow that called up a couple of minutes ago, he was talking about bats.
Yep.
And I was talking to an old-time carpenter one time, and I asked him why in the older houses they put windows up there when obviously it wasn't a living space. And he said that the light during the day, the bats don't like it. It would keep them out. And I was just wondering if there was anything to that or what.
Not a lot, Bill, I think, because they're, if you're talking about an attic window or even a skylight or something like that, I've certainly had many cases where bat infestations have been in buildings so equipped.
Oh.
And the reality is that once these animals are into an attic, they're back in cracks and crevices and next to ceiling joists and things like that where they've got enough darkness to keep them happy. I really don't think the light probably in and of itself has anything to do with it.
Okay.
The key to making a house bat-proof is just that, to structurally eliminate every possible crack, crevice, or opening that the animals could get into. And the good news is that these bats will not chew their way in or out like a squirrel or a rat might. They don't have the dental equipment to do that. So it has to be an existing hole, and it doesn't have to be a terribly strong solution to the hole. I mean, a lot of bubble gum shoved in the hole would be enough to discourage bats because they just can't do anything about it. So it's a structural solution to the problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Got an email from, let's see, who is this from? Scott, another Scott, says he's a huge fan of yours, but he wanted to remind you that there are, this is, and this refers to the question about fox and coyotes.
Yes.
That there are open and closed seasons.
Oh, yeah, sure.
So he didn't want it to, the impression to be left that anybody could go out at any time of the year and hunt.
Well, for something as visible, my assumption was for something as visible as a group of people in pickup trucks and hounds and so forth, obviously doing something, that's a tough violation to beat if it was being done out of season.
Yeah.
So certainly whether it's bear hunting, coyote hunting, or any other kind of hunting, with the exception of a very few unprotected species or on your own property, certainly those are subject to all the fish and wildlife regulations that are in place.
Yep, and you can get all those online at the DNR website as well. Well, let's see. We have Pete from Rural Superior came back from Arizona yesterday, looked out on his pond, saw a raccoon fishing, watched for a few minutes, decided to scare it away. Yelled at it, and it wouldn't look up. Went out and yelled 30 feet away, and it still wouldn't even look up. Finally saw him and acted as if he didn't know he was there. He wonders if it could be a rabid raccoon or what, if there's anything he should do.
Well, I mean, there are a couple possibilities here. A raccoon that shows no of what we would consider normal fear of people is problematic for one of two reasons. Either it's habituated to people because somebody's been feeding it, or it was a released pet, or whatever. That's a problem animal to begin with. But more often, an animal that exhibits lack of fear is in some way sick or injured. But there's no way to tell from what, unless the animal's captured or ultimately dies and submitted for necropsy or what have you. But that's a good animal to stay away from. There are a number of things that affect raccoons. Rabies is one of them, but it's not a common issue here in Wisconsin. So that would not be high on the likely list of suspects, but canine distemper and other problems that affect raccoons could be. So I guess the answer is, Pete, yes, an animal that behaves like that, probably something wrong with it. But what? Who knows? And in the meantime, that's just a good animal to stay away from.
Yeah, absolutely. Stephen in Waterford, on to you. Hi, Stephen.
Good morning, gentlemen. How are you?
Great.
See, I have flying squirrels in my house, and I was just wondering, is the same thing applicable like bats? So you just kind of harass them a little bit or wait till they come out and then try to find out where they're going in and out of?
Well, flying squirrels play to mixed reviews. They are beautiful little animals. When people get to see them coming into a bird feeder after dark, they're strictly nocturnal, so most people never see them at all. But if you can get them coming into an open platform feeder, which they'll use readily, and rig up a light so you can watch them, it's quite the event to see them coming and going. And in the hand, or at least close up, in the hand is not a good idea, but at least close up, they're incredibly soft. They have these huge dark eyes. They're really pretty little animals. But,
oh, they're beautiful. They're gorgeous. Yeah.
But the problem is they're still squirrels. And a squirrel in the house, a squirrel in the woods, a squirrel at the feeder, a squirrel in the yard, hey, that's okay. But a squirrel in the house is still a squirrel. And they can damage electrical insulation and chew things up and mess up the insulation and make a noise. So if you can figure out how they're getting in, they can be excluded in a way very similar to the bats with a little spring-loaded door device called a squirrel excluder. And there's at least one version manufactured by the Tomahawk Trap Company up in Tomahawk, Wisconsin. So let's say the ideal situation, boom, there's a hole the size of a ping pong ball in the side of your house, and that's how they're coming and going. then this thing is mounted, this little device, the squirrel excluder, is just stapled up on the siding, covering that hole. The squirrels go out, the door closes behind them, they can't get back in. Once you think they're all out, you make the repairs, end of problem.
Yeah.
That's kind of the ideal world. The real world is a little less clear than that. And do you have access to where they are in the house? I mean, do they seem to be in an attic that you have access to?
No, they're actually in one floor joist cavity between the first and second floor. And that cavity out in front on the back porch, there's a soffit. I think there's about a maybe a quarter-inch gap between the soffit plywood and the siding.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where they're getting in.
Well, if you can rig up an excluder, then that would work. The other alternative is kind of the universal mammal repellent that would help at least get them out on a temporary basis and then let you make repairs. Naphthalene flakes, a product like
yeah.
moth ice, which is, if there's any way you can somehow get that into the cavity, they would find that very offensive and likely vacate it at least temporarily, and then you could make the repairs.
Okay.
The only other alternative is to put a little shelf up there or something that would support a small squirrel-sized live trap and then start capturing them and removing them that way. Until you feel you've got them all. So that's kind of your range of alternatives. But the bottom line is I wouldn't try and live with them because, again, if they find their way deeper into the house and start messing with the wiring and whatnot, that's not going to be a good thing.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Yeah, they're very cute. They come out at night, and you can see them every once in a while. They walk down the screen of the back door, and then they stay there. I got 2 feet away from one and took a photograph of it, and it's they're very cute.
Yeah. Well, good luck with that.
Thanks, Stephen.
Thank you.
By the way, if you have some neat wildlife photos this spring that you've taken, such as Stephen there, got a nice one of a flying squirrel, I'd love to have them posted on our Facebook page, which is the Larry Mueller Show. We had some great weather photos put up after we had our weather guys on recently. So if you've got some photos that you'd like to share, you can go to The Larry Mueller Show. That's the Facebook webpage, The Larry Mueller Show, and we will and just put them up. We'd love to have them. And a little note as to where and sort of at least the general area and what the experience was. Love to have it. And that's The Larry Mueller Show, The Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. And Scott, you had something else you were going to...
Oh, I just wanted to put a shameless plug in here. Every year our department, the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology, sponsors what we call the Leopold Lecture. We have a distinguished conservationist come in and talk to the campus and public community. And this year it's April 20th, coming up 2 weeks from yesterday, 6 o'clock in the Ebling Auditorium in the Microbial Sciences Building, which is right across from Russell Labs on our end of campus. And there's been quite a bit of publicity going out. But the speaker this year is Shane Mahoney from Newfoundland. And Shane is a very well-known leader in conservation across Canada and North America. And he's going to be speaking about the North American model of wildlife conservation, why what we have done here over the years in North America has been so successful, and how important it is that hunters and other conservationists work in partnership with our professional agencies to make sure that this model continues to flourish and that there's wildlife around for many generations to come. He's a fantastic speaker and quite a he's just an impressive guy to be around. And that talk is open to the public, free of charge. We're going to have a little ice cream social over in the horticultural gardens for an hour or so beforehand. And then doors will open at Ebling for about 5:45 on Tuesday the 20th. I think anybody interested in wildlife conservation in a general sense would really be inspired listening to Shane speak.
Yeah, he'll probably have some photos and everything else, would be my guess.
Yep.
And we'll take some more calls coming up here. But just to remind you, Scott Craven, our guest, UW Extension wildlife ecologist. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we'll take some more calls. Rusty in Springstead is our next caller. So let's go to Rusty. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello. Couple questions for Scott today.
Okay.
I'm just wondering, I used to fish the popple, the pine, and the Brule Rivers back in the mid-90s. over in Forest and Florence counties, and the fishing was outstanding for brookies about 15 years ago, you know, and the water levels have gone down quite a bit, and I noticed the last few years I couldn't even do hardly any navigating on the pine, very, very little. And I noticed a lot of silting going on. I'm wondering how the trout are faring in that area, and you know, if there is some restoration being done in that area for that. And my other question for Scott is, if he has read the new book that's out by an editor from the Lakeland Times called How the DNR Stole Wisconsin.
Well, Rusty, if you're still on there, my cabin's in Springstead, and I'm just wondering, I have a question for you, too. Did you get any rain in the last couple of days?
Smidgen. Not much.
We've had a lot.
River Road, if you know where that is.
Yeah, we have a lot. We've had a lot more than a smidgen down here. I was kind of hopeful. Boy, things are desperately dry up in your neck of the woods, so hopefully the rain will move up.
Yeah, it's real bad.
Well, you know, the fisheries question for the rivers you mentioned in those counties, obviously low water is a problem for a lot of things up there. But in terms of the direct impact on the fishery, I think you'd be well ahead of the game to call a local DNR fish manager and see what they're doing on those streams. A little further south, there was just an article out on the Prairie River down in Lincoln County, which is also a very well-known brook trout stream, and they were talking about the fact that flows have been pretty good and trout populations in the prairie were like at 20-year highs, really high trout populations. So it may be a reflection of water levels or restoration work, Trout Unlimited projects, things like that that are going on. But I think for specific information on the streams that you like or you have fished, you should call a local fish manager, and they're pretty familiar with what's going on. Yeah. Overall, the DNR fishing report for 2010 that just came out as a supplement in the magazine a week or so ago, that the trout biologists were looking for a really good season all across Wisconsin, assuming there's some water for the fish to swim in.
The Brule has, you know, it's warmed up a little bit, too. The temperatures, we just had a show on with some Trout Unlimited fellows. And it's turning, we're seeing a big increase in bass in that river. But the tributaries into it are still pretty good for trout, for brookies. So, you know, you might want to take a look at the tributaries in. But I like your advice as well, Scott. And just to go to the Trout Unlimited website, maybe if you're not a member, become a member of Trout Unlimited. Would be another way to sort of help that whole situation. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. We have an email here from Cindy in Eau Claire. She wants to pass along a resource. She has no affiliation with this organization other than as a fan, and it's a website, www.journeynorth.org, journeynorth.org. This site, people can track migrations of hummingbirds, also provides migration mapping for another 15, 20 species in their northern and southern migrations, and people can and are encouraged to participate by logging in their own observations. Very reliable, user-friendly, informative site to visit. So that was journeynorth.org. She also wanted a word in for the monarch butterfly because it's now on the endangered species list and wondering what can we do to help. You know, as with everything else, it's a habitat issue, and sometimes habitat here and sometimes habitat south of the border as well.
Right, and of course, a lot of these things are greatly confounded and compounded by concerns over global climate change and what's going to happen down the road 10, 20, or 30 years. So that's another important issue. I'll check out that Journey North website tonight. I just made a note of that. As far as the monarchs are concerned, there are some citizen-based initiatives around Wisconsin restoring small patches of habitat along rights of way and in people's backyards where plenty of milkweed can flourish, which is the host plant for monarch butterfly caterpillars and larvae. So there are some things individuals can do, but again, the bigger trump card of things like climate change kind of overwhelms us in certain ways. We also, Larry, I just need to mention, I didn't comment back to Rusty's question about the book about...
Oh, right.
Yeah, I have not read that. I know there's been no love lost between some factions up in the Minocqua area and the DNR, and I can imagine what the tone of the book is, but I have no other comment, I guess. I'll have to have a look at it.
Gary in Oregon, we'll go to you now. Hi, Gary.
Hi. I got a cabin by Argonne up in Forest County. And I first have a quick story. A few years ago, I was trout fishing. I was in the middle of a river about 70 feet across. It's at the top of a rapids, and I'd been fishing it for about 10 minutes. Took a break, was sitting on the rock. Coming up on the west side on the shore was a skunk, very big, portly, waddling along. And about when it got about 30 feet from me, it went into the river and swam across the river just as beautifully as you could imagine, got out the other side and shook itself a little bit and waddled off. And I thought that was an interesting thing to see.
It's an interesting thing to see. I mean, most animals swim very well, and if they want to get from one side of the river to the other, don't have a whole lot of options.
Yeah, and I just never thought of skunks as being such great swimmers. But my question was, about a month ago, I went up to the cabin, and when I opened up the wood stove and I was going to clean out the ash, I saw a small dead bat, about maybe 2.5 inches long. And so as I started to clean the ash out, there were 11 dead bats. Mm-hmm. I got a photo of it. And I just wonder, I'd never, have had trouble with bats in the cabin. Have never, had this ever happen with the stove before. And I wonder if they got confused when they got in there or if you have any ideas on that.
Well, I think that I've had the same problem in our wood-burning fireplace at the cabin in Price County, and I think I picked 9 or 10 out of the ashes last spring when I opened things up just as you did, and that's a case of where they're... I know my chimney doesn't, and yours probably doesn't have an animal-proof cap on it or a wire mesh either, and this is a case where the bats get in there thinking this is possible access into the house or roost site or whatever. And it was probably facilitated in my case by the fact that there were bats in the attic. I've since taken the steps to exclude them from there, but they find their way into whatever crack, crevice, opening tube or whatever else may lead into potential shelter. And then once they get down in there or drop through the flue or crawl through whatever the small crack is, then it's a matter of, hey, they can't find their way back out. And they eventually starve to death there in the firebox. So no. I think that's a fairly common thing, actually.
So you need to put a...
You need to put an animal-proof cap on the chimney that would keep not only bats, but starlings and squirrels and any other potential pests from dropping in there, or from a raccoon from getting in there and having a litter of young up above the damper in the spring of the year. So a cap,
you don't want that.
You don't want that. But a cap on the chimney is a good idea. You just have to make sure you get a commercial one that isn't going to clog up with soot or whatever and eventually cause a fire hazard. So it's not just a matter of getting up there and taping a bunch of screening over the top of your fireplace flue, or you can create a fire hazard.
Okay. There you have it. Thank you, Gary. Yvonne in Lake Geneva, on to you. Hi, Yvonne.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I love your program, love NPR.
Thank you.
And we listen to it at the Wildlife Hospital where I work at Fellow Mortals. And the reason I'm calling is the questions about live trapping and exclusion. Often wildlife rehabilitators get these calls first, and I'm glad that we do because there are babies this time of year.
Mm-hmm.
So I would encourage people to seek out a wildlife rehabilitator before they call an animal removal service, because we can educate, we can tell them about hazing. And the DNR has a great website under Wildlife Health that lists the rehabilitators through the state of Wisconsin. And you can find one in your area. And that is, that's why we are here, to answer questions, to provide help when necessary, to keep healthy orphans with their parents if possible. So just wanted to make sure people knew about that resource.
Good point.
Well, it's a very good point. The rehabilitators are great folks. They do great work, provide an important service, and they are identified, licensed by the DNR, so it's not hard to find one in your area. And then if you do have the circumstance where you get up in the attic to remove something, thinking it's just a big old adult, whatever it is, and all of a sudden, holy cow, there's a litter of young ones, then you've got a decision to make. You either need to take care of the whole family or just back off until the young are independent and then go ahead and worry about doing the exclusion work later. In the case of bats, for example, all of the exclusion literature and the advice that we hand out and paperwork and so forth simply says to cease and desist any bat exclusionary work in June and July, because you run the risk of excluding the females and then trapping the helpless young in the attic to ultimately die. So most of the, you know, most of the literature websites and so forth are sensitive to that problem and try and alert people to it. What many of the pest control operators do or how they handle removal and an associated litter of young may be handled in different ways, but I can't say much about that. So if you can help in that regard, then we appreciate the help.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Yvonne.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Looking at our Wisconsin wildlife today with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, Larry Mueller here. Thank you very much for listening in. Join us with the call at 1-800-642-1234 or email at talk@wpr.org. John in Sparta has a comment for you, Scott, or question. Let's go there. Hi, John.
Yes, good afternoon. I guess I'm a hunter and wildlife enthusiast for 45-plus years. And it disturbs me that the bear hunting, dog bear hunting in Wisconsin supersedes the wolf population. In other words, the hunters who train their dogs and stuff in the woods, in the northern woods, make it very clear that they carry a rifle and a shovel and don't hesitate to kill every wolf they see. And I think somebody should make it clear to them that that their sport can be eliminated, too. There used to be in dogs not allowed to hunt and chase bear, and the wolves were here a lot, preceded them, and are and have benefit to our environment, and somebody ought to make it clear to the those hunters that their position is very poor, and things can change.
Well, John, I mean, there's a lot of truth to what you say. The unfortunate reality is that the wolf issue and the related issues involving bear hunting are very polarizing, and there are certainly extremists on both ends of the spectrum that, you know, maybe carry shovels and rifles. I think that there are far more responsible, concerned bear hunters than there are those that are carrying rifles and shovels, which is a good thing. And I'm sure the bear hunters are very much aware that some aspects of bear hunting, like the use of hounds and bait and so forth, is contentious, and that there are a lot of folks, hunters and non-hunters alike, who choose to not participate and so forth. So I suspect they're well aware that their position is somewhat tenuous, but it does have a long history and heritage in Wisconsin. So as long as everybody behaves reasonably responsibly, I hope we can all get along. The issue that some bear hounds are being killed by wolves is, of course, a controversy in its own right, and depending on how you feel about it, it's either a huge problem or a non-problem. But certainly for someone who loses a dog that they've invested a lot of training in, or that essentially a family pet or whatnot, it's a traumatic experience. But the issue is trying to make a place for wolves, a place for bear hunting, and a place for everybody else all on the same piece of landscape, which isn't always an easy thing to do.
Yeah. Thanks for calling, John. Appreciate it. Mike in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I'm actually in South Milwaukee, and I live in Grant Park along Lake Michigan, and I have questions related to things I see in the park. Number one, why are there so many of these giant Canadian geese present today? When I was growing up, they were almost never seen. Mm-hmm. Number two, the steelhead trout and the salmon run up the Oak Creek across the street from my house. And I don't know, do the trout run in the fall and the salmon in the spring, or did both species run at both times of the year? And if so, why does some run in the spring and some in the fall? And then number three, in between the time I called in and when I got on the air, I saw some, I think they're turkey vultures flying around. in the backyard. Are they migrating now or what?
Okay, so Canada geese,
trout and salmon, and turkey vultures. All right, well, let's deal with the geese first. That's an easy one. These resident giant Canada geese that you describe are, in fact, a race or subspecies of Canada geese. But these big ones that were native to our part of the landscape but were pretty much eliminated at the time a lot of other wildlife was eliminated, have made a tremendous comeback. Giant Canada geese were only rediscovered as recently, I think it was 1965, with a remnant population in Rochester, Minnesota. But when they were rediscovered, essentially, they never really were extinct, obviously. Those, and then there was a small population established that winters on the Rock Prairie Goose Refuge down on the Rock-Walworth County line in Wisconsin, and a few others were discovered. And because they were a native bird, as we've done with many native species, there was a very concerted restoration effort to bring giant Canada geese, which typically nest here in the States rather than further north in Canada, and they're bigger, bring them back to the Dakotas and the Midwest and so forth. And they came back, and they turned out to be very prolific, very tolerant of people. And it turns out that a lot of what we've done to the landscape, creating industrial parks and parks and green spaces and so forth. Golf courses with nice little ponds and lots of turf and nobody's hunting in these places. Holy cow, this was goose heaven. So as a result, once a few geese get the idea and start to populate an area, the population can grow rather quickly. And at times back in the 90s, the giant Canada goose population in the Midwest was growing at rates approaching 14-15% a year. And they've since repopulated all of their former area and then some, and they do very well in suburban and urban areas. So there are lots of programs around the country that are rounding up these birds and reducing the populations in very aggressive, direct ways. But they're going to be a fact of life for a long time in public spaces. As far as the trout and salmon, depends on the strain, the trout strain. Most of the salmon, I think, are fall spawners. Some of the trout are spring spawners. And then they've got some strains of trout that are fall spawners. And it's kind of a mixed-up mishmash. But they obviously, these are all fish among the steelheads and some of the other runs of trout and the salmon that come back to either where they were stocked or their natal stream to reproduce. And that, of course, is the basis of part of the important fishery in the Great Lakes system and Lake Michigan in particular. I don't know where that question was headed, Larry. So maybe
just wondering how they, if they spawn at one time or another, salmon versus trout.
It's inherent in the species or the strain in terms of when they come in to spawn. And it could be spring or fall, but I think overall the fall spawning period, at least for the salmon, is a bigger deal. As far as the turkey vultures are concerned, yes, they are moving through along with all other birds, and that's probably what's being seen, are birds in migration.
Yep. Martha in Racine, your turn. Hi, Martha.
Hi. I'd like to talk about great horned owls.
Okay.
I live next to a small little wooded area. My husband and I heard them hooting all winter long. They hooted in the evening.
Mm-hmm.
And now I think we found the babies.
Okay.
And I was just wondering, when do they get fed? Because they just sit there. We can find them on, they move from branch to branch a little bit, but they seem to just sit there all day. And when do the parents feed them?
Well, great horned owls are quite common in every little woodlot and patch of trees, even on the edge of suburbia. And they were calling very vigorously a while back. They're one of our earliest birds to nest, you know, establishing nests usually in February. And there would be young out now from that nesting effort. But the young pretty much do just sit around. I mean, after all, they are owls, so they hunt primarily at night. So the adults, if they're still feeding them at all, are visiting them primarily when they're hunting as a result of their hunting success in the darkness.
Oh, okay.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Yep, thanks so much for calling. Steve in Appleton emailed to remind me that it's the upper Wolf, when we were talking about trout, and problems with the Brule River, and it was really the Wolf River that is turning into a bass water, not the Brule. And I apologize for that mistake. It's it definitely is the upper Wolf and not the Brule.
Well, who knows? With climate change, it could be the rule before long. I mean, bass are being blamed for overtaking a lot of fisheries in the North Woods in terms of taking over a lot of lake systems and whatnot. So, hey, I don't really mind. I like to catch bass. But on the other hand, if it's detrimental to the balance of other species, then it's a problem.
And Sean in Eau Claire, on to you now. Hi, Sean.
Hi. The other day, I was walking outside, and I heard something running down a hill, because we have a hill in our backyard, and I went over there, and, it was a groundhog, but I didn't know it was a groundhog, and so I started chasing after it, and it ran right up a tree, and I wouldn't have thought it would run up a tree, so, and so I went out there, and I just stood at it, and I just watched it for a while, and it wouldn't move at all. And it was there for about an hour and a half, and then I went back down to it, and it was still there. And so I figured that it couldn't climb down the tree. So my dad and I put a log up to it and came back about a half hour later, and it was gone.
Well, that was very thoughtful. But I think from the woodchuck's perspective, you know, here it was being chased around by someone 8 or 10 times its size, and it was probably a little traumatized. The fact that it went up a tree is no great surprise. I mean, woodchucks or groundhogs, either name is okay, are members of the squirrel family, and they climb very well. They don't look like they would be able to because they're so fat and round and short-legged, but they actually climb very well, which is why a fence around a garden is a lousy means of protecting your garden from woodchuck problems. So they do climb, and it's not just when they're pressed. Occasionally they'll climb up in a tree to feed on new growth and vegetation, and that animal was probably more than capable of getting down on its own, but that was very nice of you after you chased it up the tree to provide a ladder for it to get back down.
Well, yeah, because I haven't seen those around here very often. So
well, and it's if you have a garden or lots of tulips and things like that, you should be thankful you don't see them around very much.
That's exactly right.
They're a major garden pest. So
thanks, Sean. Tom in Egg Harbor, on to you.
All right, morning.
Morning.
This coming Tuesday is a Conservation Congress hearings, and State Council at TU has a concern on advisory question 87. Apparently there's a move by some guys to extend the stream trout fishing season into October. Well, if you know anything about trout biology, you know that that's when our native brookies and browns spawn.
Mm-hmm.
And wading activity in those streams at that time is detrimental to eggs and fry and to the reds. This is a very bad idea. So I, as state council rep for Green Bay chapter, and also the state council, which has taken an official position on this, just want to let people know about this and urge them to vote no on advisory number 87. It seems there's just a crowd of bucket biologists somewhere up north. They've been coming along every couple of years or every year for the last couple of years with some goofball proposition that they can just fish whatever they want, whenever they want, however they want, in any stream they want without having any restrictions. I don't know what the impetus behind all this is, but it's a really bad idea. And, TU does a lot of volunteer work and donates a lot of money, and everybody, not just TU members, gets to benefit from the increased populations and the better streams. So if you're going, we'd just like you to vote no on question 87.
Okay, thanks for that comment. I should point out, I think you mentioned Tuesday evening. It's actually Monday. The Congress hearings are always on a Monday night. And
April 12th, isn't it?
Yep. And that's exactly why the Congress hearings occur, is so that people there's essentially a vetting, or people have a chance to examine these questions, hear from both sides, and then say, hey, wait a minute, this doesn't make a whole lot of sense, and they get voted down. Or even if it's a close vote, there's still another review essentially at the Natural Resources Board level before these things just become, I think it's a good idea that we do this or that. And there's enough steps and safeguards between someone coming up with that idea and it actually happening that the system usually works pretty well.
Well, yeah. Sometimes you get blindsided. They pushed the thing on the Prairie River a while back about limits and sizes, and it went through, and it's DNR or whatever didn't buck it. Maybe it just didn't seem to be in their political best interest, but TU was very disappointed in that. And so we just want to get people out and make sure they vote no on advisory 87.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks very much.
Thank you very much for calling. Scott, this time of the year, we start hearing those spring peepers, among other things, huh?
Well, it's great. I mean, one of the nicest sounds of spring for me is to hear those first frogs out and about. Usually begins with wood frogs further north of us, and then around here, the chorus frogs and the spring peepers, and then the toads and the leopard frogs, and progresses all the way through the bullfrogs and green frogs in midsummer. So there's a nice extended chorus, and the nice thing about it is, A, the songs are very beautiful. Even for an animal as warty and funny-looking as a toad, their high-pitched trill is, unless it happens pretty. To be under your bedroom window and lasts all night long, it's rather pretty. So it's a nice thing. The songs carry a long way for the most part, so you know spring is here when the frogs start singing. And there's only 11 or 12 species that you might have to deal with, so it's easy to learn the calls, so you can figure out who's actually singing, and there are some great resources for that. A couple new ones arrived on my desk a couple days ago. We've used Randy Korb's CDs in the past to play some of these calls, and he has a new one out called Calls of Wisconsin Frogs, and this is actually a DVD that has video of the frogs singing, so you hear them and actually see them at the same time. And then an accompanying piece called Blinky, a special gray tree frog. And it's a kid's book, but it contains a CD with the frog calls. But it's really a neat way of getting kids interested in amphibians and conservation through learning about that one particular frog. So I think, let's see, if anybody's interested in that stuff, the website is just St. Croix Wildlife, all one word, .org, and I think they can find it that way. And then get out there and learn those frog calls. Absolutely. And listen in, because it's a fun thing to do.
Absolutely. And what was the website again? It was
stcroixwildlife.org. Oh. And St. Croix is in the river, stcroixwildlife.org.
Let's turn to Dole in Rhinelander next. Hi, thank you for calling.
You bet. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to give a few phenology points from up here in the Northwoods. Number one, this last week the kids were on spring break and we got to go out, and the salamander migration is underway already up here.
Wow.
Very amazing, but we had...
Usually the salamanders would need snowshoes. Go ahead.
Yeah, okay. And also we were out filming the woodcock displays as well.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is, there was a call earlier in the program about loons. I don't know if it was Minocqua or in that neck of the woods, saying that they hadn't made it up there yet. I've been out paddling the last 2 days, and 50% of the lakes I've been on, we've had one loon. I'm guessing the males are back, and hopefully the females will be right around the corner, would be my guess.
Okay.
Yep. All right.
So the fact of the matter is that stuff is happening fast all the way up in the Rhinelander area, which is, you know, ordinarily, gee, the 1st of April, a salamander would need snowshoes to be out there marching around. So this is, it's pretty neat. I'm glad everything's happening quickly. I hope we don't suffer a relapse in mid-April and all of a sudden get snow and ice again, but hopefully that won't happen. But thanks for the observations.
Thank you.
Appreciate it, Dole.
People being out there taking note of what's going on in a phenological sense as they plot the events of spring is providing an important database as people try and understand changes due to climate change and a whole host of other things. So it's good that people are interested.
Let's turn to Frank in Port Edwards next. Hi, Frank.
Good day, gentlemen.
Good day.
A friend of mine reported something I'd never heard of before. They were coming over from Black River Falls to Wisconsin Rapids an evening after dark. And at a certain place, there were a lot of frogs on the road and owls catching and eating the frogs. Have you ever heard of that?
I have not, but it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, when breeding concentrations or movements of any animal occurs on a warm, rainy night when the salamanders are out or the leopard frogs or anything else, this is a tremendous burst of food, a pulse of food for a whole slew of things. Just like the robins are in Fat City now with the rain down here, the streets are covered with night crawlers, and robins don't have to work very hard for a square meal. And I suspect that a concentration of frogs moving across a road that bisects a wetland or something would be easy pickings for a whole host of things. And sometimes birds that you don't expect to eat certain things will take advantage of the situation. I remember a year or so ago in the program, we had a caller, and then it turned out to be several callers, who had great blue herons.
Yeah.
Walking up from the lake or pond on lakeshore property, standing around their bird feeder, stock still, and a chipmunk would come out to get a seed, and wham! Heron would grab the chipmunk, walk back to the pond, and that's it for the chipmunk. So most animals are opportunistic, and if there's an easy food supply available, they'll take advantage of it. But I never heard of owls picking off frogs before. That's a good one.
That's a good one. Thank you, Frank.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it. Anne in Eau Claire wonders if you have hints for attracting bluebirds and then wondering when the hummingbirds return. Well, the hummingbirds are on their way.
Well, the hummingbirds will be back soon, and we had an earlier report that some early ones have already gotten back to the southern counties. And the short answer to the question as far as bluebird issues, what has been largely responsible for the restoration and building of bluebird populations is the great interest in putting out bluebird nest boxes. And there are lots of designs available. If you have somebody in the family who can make your own, there are many available commercially. And if you want to get into that in a big way or get more information, contact your local DNR office or a nature center in the Eau Claire area, maybe the folks at Beaver Creek over in Fall Creek, and see who the county coordinator is for the Bluebird Restoration Association of Wisconsin, BRAW, and they've got information packets and house designs and all sorts of stuff that'll get you on your way to being overwhelmed with bluebirds.
Cindy in Menominee, on to you. Hi, Cindy.
Hi there. I've been participating in the Frog and Toad Survey for the last couple of years in Chippewa County and really enjoyed that. It's an established, route of 10 stops. But they're looking this year for volunteers who would be willing to give them some information about the frog sounds that they're hearing either by their homes or where they walk regularly or work regularly or something. So I just wanted to put that out there because maybe people would be willing to contribute more information about the frog.
Well, where would they go to do that, Cindy?
Well, I think it must be the DNR.
Okay.
Yeah, the Frog and Toad Survey is coordinated by the Bureau of Endangered Resources and the DNR. You can find information on their website. And the good news is, Cindy, that lots of people are interested in what we now have come to know as citizen science, and whether it's Project Salamander or the Frog and Toad Survey or a myriad of bird counts, there are lots of people out there doing these kinds of things and having a really good time doing it. So getting involved in some new aspects of the Frog and Toad Survey would be a good way to spend some time outdoors.
Yep. Thank you for calling. And someone wanted you to talk a little bit more. We got maybe 30 or 40 seconds to talk about the salamander moving about.
Well, salamanders are, of course, amphibians like frogs, and they need, with the exception of the redback salamander, they need to get to water to reproduce. So any time from late February in the south to about now up in the Northwoods, when the conditions are right and there's good moisture, then the salamander species are moving from where they spend the winter or most of their upland season, moving to the breeding ponds and reproducing just like the frogs are, except salamanders don't make any noise. They're very quiet and secretive. So unless you happen to see them crossing the road or piling up in your window well or something like that, you never really know that the salamanders are on the move.
Scott, always a pleasure. You'll be back first Wednesday of May. Oh, my goodness. Yep. The year is flying by. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest today, and he will be back the first Wednesday of May. I don't know what that date is, but we'll warn you on our Facebook. And remember, the Larry Mueller Facebook page, if you've got some neat outdoor pictures or wildlife pictures, we'd love to have them up on the site. So send them to us or your comments as well. Ken Adams, John Freiberger join us tomorrow to talk about home renovation and repair. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.